is more than the dynamics of space-time. It tells you how, it tells you that, you know, gravity and secretly may be the same as a quantum many-body system. So this poster kind of represents, you know, this picture here is it's a particular many-body system that I will be talking about later. And this apple is, of course, gravity. So that's the basic idea. If you don't remember anything at all, just remember this. And if you want to know more about how this works, ask Lydia, because she's teaching a class about this whole business. So there are a number of reviewed papers on the subject. I can tell you what they are. But anyway, so the plan of my talk is to tell you three stories. So first story is about liquids, second is about quantum, and third story is about the black holes. And then there's going to be a unification of how this works. So liquids is something that's very easy to understand. Well, so actually, it's actually very easy to visualize. It's very difficult to understand. So what I have here is a phase diagram of a typical substance like water. And pressure is on the vertical axis, temperature is on the horizontal axis. So there are three phases, solid, liquid, and gas. And there's a critical point somewhere in here. So the lines here are the lines of first order phase transitions. Of course, when the line of a first order phase transition ends, it terminates at a line of a second order, it terminates at a point of a second order transition. And so this line kind of goes up. It goes up this way. So transition from liquid to gas is, of course, the boiling transition when water boils. And it's easy to understand why this line has to go this way, right? Because, you know, if you go higher up in the mountain, then pressure is lower, right? So pressure is lower, so water boils at a lower temperature. Okay? So this line goes down like that. And for water, this critical point right here happens at, you know, 374 degrees and 220 times atmospheric pressure. So one thing that you note is that you can go from here to here without crossing the phase transition line. So there is really not much of a difference between liquid and gas. And really, you can understand this because you can understand this from a symmetry reason, because there is no different symmetry that distinguishes liquid phase and the gas phase. You know, when you go from gas to solid or liquid to solid, there is a symmetry breaking that happens, but there is no symmetry breaking. There is no symmetry that distinguishes the liquid phase and the gas phase. And because there's two phases, you know, the liquid and the gas phase, they look kind of very similar. So you expect the same equations that describe the macroscopic flow of liquids and gases. These are, of course, equations of fluid dynamics. So I'll tell you what they are. The equations of fluid dynamics are, you can find in basically any decent fluid dynamics book. So the first one is the conservation. Well, okay, so the first one is the conservation of mass, second is the conservation of momentum, third is the conservation of energy. Basically, three conservation laws. So if you look at textbooks of fluid dynamics, they usually don't tell you these equations in this form all on one page. So they first will tell you like this equation, then half of that equation, then they will massage this equation somehow into the entropy, you know, current conservation or something like that. But basically, there are three equations. So rho here is mass density, V is the velocity of the fluid, P is pressure, E is energy density. So of course, these equations ignore viscosity. If you take viscosity into account, you'll get what's called Navier-Stokes equations. And so what this means, under this viscous stress that sits in the energy current and in the momentum current, and there is this heat conductivity term that sits here. And this viscous stress is just proportional to various derivative combinations of the velocity. So there's three numbers. There's three numbers which are responsible for dissipation in fluids. One is the shear viscosity, the other is the bulk viscosity, the other one is the thermal conductivity. There are only three. And these equations, you know, these equations of hydrodynamics, they describe quite a lot. They describe a lot of things. You know, it was pointed out many years ago that everything flows, right? Of course, he didn't mean the Niagara Falls, but I mean, if we take into account, if we take this seriously, you know, if we take it seriously that everything flows, then everything includes, you know, water, it includes air, tar, honey, it actually includes the quark-gluon plasma, which I will be talking about later. You know, basically everything here is, you can think about everything as a translation invariant quantum field theory with a stable equilibrium state. And of course, how well everything flows depends on the viscosity of that something, right? So I want to talk about viscosity a little bit. And the first thing I want to talk about is this pitch drop experiment, which you probably have seen. But if you have not, it's a very cute thing. So it's an experiment that even a theorist can do. Right? And the experiment goes like that. Well, you take pitch, and pitch doesn't look like a liquid. So because you know, you stick it with a hammer, you hit it with a hammer, and it's very brittle, breaks into pieces. Now, in fact, it is a liquid. And if you don't believe that it's a liquid, you can make this experiment that even theoretical physicists can do. And the way you do this experiment, you do the following. You take this pitch, which is quite brittle, and you put it in a funnel. And that's it. You wait. And wait, and wait, and wait, and wait, and wait. Because this is not the person who started this experiment. The person who started this experiment died many years ago. But the experiment is still running. And what happens is 80 drops fell so far since year 1927, when the experiment started. The last one fell in year 2000. No one ever witnessed a drop fall. In fact, they set up a video camera to record the eighth drop when it was about to detach itself. But on that day, the camera malfunctioned, and nobody ever saw how a drop falls out of this funnel. This experiment won the Ig Nobel Prize in 2005. Well, if you don't know what this Ig Nobel Prize, well, did you know about this Ig Nobel Prize? Yeah, I mean, this is a very cute thing, you know, that, you know, they give you prizes for various funny kind of things of research, where the people, you know, write papers about how to cure hiccups with digital rectal massage or something like that. But anyway, so the point is, it's a liquid. And the viscosity of this liquid is, you know, it's 10 to 11 times the viscosity of water, so it's pretty viscous. But it's still a liquid, and there's one very easy way to think about viscosity. Well, not in liquids, but in gases. So the way to think about viscosity in gases is to think about viscosity as something that measures internal friction between layers of fluid. So if you imagine, you know, fluid that goes from right to left here. You know, this green arrows, they represent, blue arrows represent the velocity, so the liquid moves faster here, it moves slower here. And you know, the particles, they jump kind of up and down. So if a particle jumps from this fast moving layer, if it jumps down, so it carries with itself a larger X momentum. So when a particle jumps from this layer to this layer, it speeds up the bottom layer. So conversely, if a particle jumps from here to here, it slows down the top layer. So you can see that viscosity that tells you about the rate of equilibration of velocity here is going to be proportional to the mean free path of these particles. And well, the precise definition of the viscosity is, of course, its relation of the stress tensor to the gradient of velocity. And you know, the way you do this estimate is like that. So particle number that crosses per unit surface per unit time is basically n times average thermal velocity of your particles. So to see what is the momentum that flows per unit surface per unit time, you multiply this by momentum of each individual particle. When you look at the flux, you basically need to see what the velocity is going to be here versus here. And when you subtract the two fluxes, you see that the difference is going to be proportional to the gradient of velocity and the mean free path. Right, okay, so the mean free path is inversely proportional to the cross section for your particles in a gas. And you know, thermal velocity is proportional to the square root of temperature. So that's what viscosity depends on. That's what viscosity, you know, is more or less in gases, proportional to the square root of temperature. Maxwell derived this in 1800. So viscosity does depend on temperature, does not depend on you know, density or pressure. And when Maxwell found this, he was very puzzled. So he wrote that such a consequence of the mathematical theory, namely the fact that viscosity does not depend on density, is very startling, and the only experiment I have met with on the subject does not seem to confirm it. So, of course, Maxwell trusted his own theory, which is now known as the kinetic theory, and he set out to test his own theory, so he built an apparatus. So he was not only a theorist, he was an experimentalist as well. So with the help of his wife, he measured, you know, viscosity of air using this torsional pendulum. So this is on display at the Cambridge Museum, together with Maxwell's desk, which stands right next to it. And in 1865, you know, he reported that kinetic theory is right. Viscosity indeed does not depend on density, it depends on temperature. So this was for gases. Now, I didn't tell you about viscosity of liquids or how to calculate the viscosity of liquids, because it's a much more difficult problem. But you know, just want to say something about the terminology. And you know, terminology is that, you know, ideal gas is a gas that has no interaction between particles. And ideal fluid, so that's the definition of ideal fluid, as ideal fluid is a fluid that has no viscosity. Right? Now, in a gas, viscosity is inversely proportional to the cross-section for scattering of your atoms in a gas. So ideal gas has no interactions, therefore cross-section is equal to zero, therefore viscosity in ideal gas is infinite. Now, if your gas is not ideal but near ideal, it has huge viscosity because cross-section is very, very small. So ideal gas behaves as a very, very non-ideal fluid. And it's just, you know, a coincidence that the same word ideal is used to talk about both ideal fluid and ideal gas, because ideal gas really has nothing to do with ideal fluid. If a gas is truly ideal, of course, it never flows in the first place because it never thermalizes, because interactions are required for local thermalization. So this picture shows the range of viscosity. So what I plotted here is not viscosity, but it's actually more visually appealing to plot viscosity divided by the density of entropy in some units. And so this is a typical curve of what viscosity over density or viscosity over entropy depends on temperature. So it increases in the gas phase. It decreases with temperature in the liquid phase. There's going to be some kind of minimum in between the two. If you're going through a phase transition, like here, there's going to be some jump in viscosity around the phase transition point. So viscosities have a huge range. So if you think about glycerin, as you heat it up from 0 degrees to 100 degrees, you know, viscosity goes down by, you know, I don't know, by a huge factor. For water, it doesn't change, you know, that much. But it still does depend on viscosity. But, you know, when you say viscosity is equal to something, it's really very sensitive to temperature and pressure. So viscosity is not something that's, you know, for engineers, right? It's something that physicists have a great interest in. And so I'm about to show you a little quote from this paper. It's called Life at Low Reynolds Number by Ed Purcell. So Purcell is, of course, he's one of the two Nobel Prize winners for this discovery of the nuclear magnetic resonance. And Weisskopf is, well, you know who Weisskopf is, right? No? Well, he was a nuclear physicist, nuclear theorist. You know, was as a director of CERN for a number of years, worked on the Manhattan Project, worked against nuclear proliferation, and actually was the first one to calculate the Lamb shift in hydrogen. But he was afraid that his calculation was wrong because it disagreed with Feynman and Schwinger, so he did not publish it. So other people published the calculation before him, so he didn't get his Nobel Prize. Anyway, so Weisskopf was very well known for explaining everything using very, very simple physical arguments. So he would go and explain to you, for example, why quantum mechanics is relevant to the height of mountains. So you know about this, right? You can ask yourself this question, like, why are there no mountains which are, you know, 200 kilometers high? The highest mountains we have on Earth is only up to 10 kilometers. So what does quantum mechanics have to do with this sphere? And of course, it boils down to interatomic interactions. Right. But you know, it's this kind of simple physics things that Weisskopf like to talk about, and viscosity of liquids is something that apparently defies this simple kind of dimensional estimate, because you know viscosity of liquids is actually has this kind of scaling with temperature. It's exponential. It's, you know, it's inverse exponential, what you can probably do, you can probably predict what sits in the exponential, and so that's what Purcell thought that Weisskopf would argue for his naive or not naive but his simple estimate of viscosity. But then he pointed out that it's actually more mysterious than the simple estimate, because if you look at the chemical rubber handbook, you will find that there's almost no liquid with viscosity that is much lower than the viscosity of water. So viscosities have a big range, but they stop at the same place. Says, I don't understand this. I leave this for Weisskopf to explain. And indeed, so if you were to look at this plot here, if you were to look at, you know, let's say viscosity divided by entropy, you know, take any substance and, you know, it will look more or less like that, but it will not go much lower than this curve, than about here. Right? So what is the reason? What is the reason that you know, viscosities do not become very, very small? And actually nobody knows the reason. But you can give a simple hand waving argument you know, about viscosity, what it should be or what it could be, if you approach it from the gas side, not from the liquid side. So think about viscosity per particle. So viscosity per particle, so N is the number density, something that's called kinematic viscosity, something that tells you about the damping of sound waves, it's something that tells you about the value of the Reynolds number, which determines the onset of turbulence. So it's really the viscosity, this kinematic viscosity, which is relevant for hydrodynamics, not kind of the normal viscosity. And if you estimate what it is from the gas side, you know, viscosity is, you know, mass times the number density times average velocity of your molecules times the mean free path divided by the density. Well, the density cancels. You get mean free path times mass times velocity. Okay, it's x times p. So it's got to be greater than h bar. Otherwise, the very notion of your particle is not well defined. Otherwise, particles simply don't exist. So you see, it kind of suggests that Heisenberg uncertainty relation, it prevents the existence of ideal liquids in nature. And what this tells you is that strongly interacting quantum liquids are the ones that are most likely to be the most ideal liquids in nature. And so if you want something to have very, very small viscosity, it's got to be something quantum. So gases would not do it because, you know, as we saw, gases typically have near ideal gases have very large viscosity. Right, so this brings me to my second story, which is quantum, because, you know, there's h bar here. So if you want to talk about nearly perfect liquids, you have to talk about quantum liquids. So what is the story of quantum? There are different types of quantum liquids that you can think of. You can think about this type of quantum liquid that's not the one that I'm going to be talking about. Well, there are other types of quantum liquids, right? So one type of quantum liquid is the liquid where quantum effects produce macroscopic long-range correlation between particles. These are superfluids. This would be helium below 2 degrees Kelvin. And so what this picture tells you about the appearance of superfluid vortices. If you take a bucket of helium and start to rotate it, then you know, vortices start to appear. And the existence of these vortices is, of course, because it's a quantum liquid, because it's not you know, classical gaseous liquid. So there is another type of quantum liquid. Another type of quantum liquid is liquid where quantum effects produce extremely low viscosity in normal fluids. Right? So these are not super fluids, these are normal fluids, but quantum fluctuations are so strong that viscosity becomes very, very small. So this type of liquids were only discovered very recently when studying very, very hot gases of subnuclear particles. Well, subnuclear simply means quarks and gluons. Are there any questions at this point? No, everything makes sense. Everything is very simple. Yes, no, maybe. All right, so superfluids, I'm not going to be talking about superfluids much, but think about superfluids as a macroscopic realization of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the symmetry that's relevant here is the particle number symmetry that multiplies your quantum field by phase. So this field is the field in your favorite scalar non-relativistic quantum field theory. Now, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, you will have Goldstone bosons, of course, and it so happens that Goldstone boson will make its way into the Navier-Stokes equation through basically the gradient of the phase of the order parameter will become what people call the superfluid velocity, and the superfluid velocity will also appear in your Navier-Stokes equations in addition to the normal velocity. If you think about the viscosity of superfluids, you probably heard, you know, somewhere that superfluids have zero viscosity. It's false. Superfluids have finite, non-zero viscosity. It can be measured. It has been measured many times by the standard, you know, torsional pendulum experiment. And the viscosity of superfluids is still compatible with this simple dimensional estimate that it gives you. But I won't be talking much about superfluids. I will be talking a little bit about this hot subnuclear matter. So if you think about hot matter, so there are two scales, two energy scales where the degrees of freedom rearrange themselves. So one is the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking, which is 100 GeV. And another one is the scale of core confinement, which is about 1 GeV. And this scale, the lower scale, is much more interesting, I think. At least for me, this is more interesting on this scale. And the reason for that is that dynamics at that scale is more rich. And this is the scale where your protons and neutrons melt when you heat them up, and they become quarks and gluons. The simple picture that I took from the website of the relativistic heavy ion collider in Brookhaven. So where they do precisely that experiment, that they take heavy nuclei, smash them into each other, and produce what people thought was the quark-gluon plasma, which what people now understand is the quark-gluon liquid. So in the way you make this hot subnuclear matter, well, so it's a picture of relativistic heavy ion collider in Brookhaven from Google Maps. So you can also see it on Google Maps as a little circle on Long Island here. So it started in the year 2000, collides gold nuclei at center of mass energy, 200 GeV per nucleon. And in 2005, the Brookhaven lab released this press release where they say that the degree of collective interaction, rapid thermalization, extremely low viscosity of the matter being formed at the collider make this the most nearly perfect liquid ever observed. Well, and of course, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is also doing similar experiments, but now with lead nuclei, not with gold nuclei. So what is the viscosity of this quark-gluon liquid? So it would be very nice, you know, to use a torsional pendulum, you know, take a jar of the quark-gluon liquid, to take a torsional pendulum, you know, look at the damping rate of a torsional pendulum. But the temperature is way too high. The temperature is way too high, and what you do is you use the relativistic hydrodynamic evolution of whatever the state is created in your collision. And even though there are large uncertainties, you still try to fit it, you know, to data. And the fit that you get is this. Well, the viscosity over entropy density, so in units of h bar, so this is everything here is multiplied by h bar, is about, you know, 0.1 plus minus something. So it's very, very small. In units of h bar, it's a small number. So you can ask what this number would be if you were to calculate it in QCD. Well, of course, you cannot calculate it in QCD because QCD at the energies of the phase transition that takes you from hadrons to quarks and gluons is a strongly coupled field theory. So you cannot use perturbative QCD. You can only use perturbative QCD at very, very high energies where QCD coupling is small. But you can still try, you know, calculate at very, very high energy and extrapolate to low energy. So what you find is that this cost over entropy density is about 1.6 times h bar. And you can ask, can you do this on the lattice and lattice QCD? The answer is you cannot, or at least it's very, very hard. Nobody has done it so far. And you know, the lesson is this is very different than this. So it's too large to explain the data. Which makes sense, right? Because this calculation was obtained in a near ideal gas of quarks and gluons. And you know, I said earlier that if you have a near ideal gas, viscosity is going to be large. And indeed, it's too large to explain the data. Well, okay. So what happens? So what do we do? Well, okay. So there is this puzzle. And this puzzle has been around for some time. But the puzzle is this. Static thermodynamic properties of the quark-gluon liquid are very, very close to the ideal gas. Right. Now, on the other hand, the dynamic flow properties of the quark-gluon liquid are very, very different from the ideal gas. Now, how can this be? Well, I don't know. It's just a fact of life, but that's what it is. So something that, you know, thermodynamics looks very close to the ideal gas. Dynamics looks very different from the ideal gas. But basically, what this tells you is that you need a better handle, on the quark-gluon liquid to try to understand this kind of discrepancies. And quite surprisingly to many people, this better handle came from string theory. You can ask, okay, wait. So isn't string theory only supposed to be relevant at very, very high energy scales, you know, 10 to the 19 GeV. So what does string theory have to do with this? Because we are only talking about energies of the order 1 GeV, which is the transition from the confined phase to the deconfined phase. Well, the answer is, you know, string theory is big. It's really big. Just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. You may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but it's just peanuts to string theory, right? String theory is big. So, and we're only going to need some of the mathematical structures that come from string theory. We're not going to need the connection to high energy physics. So if you imagine that tomorrow string theory is dead as a theory of quantum gravity, this mathematical connection is still going to stay. Because in what I'm going to do, I'm not going to use any connection to actual particle phenomenology. I'm only going to use mathematical structures, which are there regardless of the connections to particle physics. So this brings me to a third story. Third story is black holes. So far, it's going to be a little bit disconnected from the first two stories, the liquid and the quantum. But then I will bring all of them together. Are there any questions so far? No. Yes. No. Maybe. All right. So. The black holes, you know, when you open a newspaper, you know, a popular website, so they give you some pictures there. So if you are artistically inclined, so this is a modernist representation of a black hole. Okay. So that's a realist representation of the black hole. But if you're a physicist, you do something else. So I took this picture from the black hole flight simulator. I don't know if you have seen his website, guys. It's pretty nice. So, but see, what he does, he basically takes the background of our Milky Way and traces the geodesics for light coming from all the stars. And you know what you can do? You can imagine falling into the black hole, and you know this program will tell you what you're going to see around yourself. So what black holes are? They're basically strongly gravitating, self-gravitating lumps of space-time. They're solutions to Einstein equations of general relativity. And you know, if you stick black hole in flat space, the distances are going to be measured by this line element, which is, of course, the Schwarzschild metric, derived a long time ago. Now, but in addition, black holes behave like thermal systems. And so it is this connection between black holes and thermal systems which is going to be relevant to what I'm going to talk about later. Now in which sense are these black holes thermal systems? Now the first, this black hole thermodynamics that you can hear so much about, especially you know when theorists talk to each other, it does not refer to thermodynamics of hot gas around astrophysical black holes. So rather, it refers to properties of space-time itself. So thermodynamics is associated with space-time itself without any matter around black holes. And so what this means is that the equations of gravity, which describe the static properties of black holes, they simply look like the equations of thermodynamics. Just kind of, you look at you know one set of equations, another set of equations, they kind of look the same. And this analogy between black holes and thermodynamics was only found in the 1970s. I think the first systematic presentation is by Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking in 1973. You know, it's just a mathematical analogy. So, but you can ask yourself this question. So is there any deeper reason behind this, or is it just a purely mathematical analogy? Well, okay. So this thermodynamics is kind of funny. You know, okay. So the first law, the first or whatever it's called, the zeroth law of thermodynamics is actually okay. So it tells you that black hole, the stationary state is determined by, you know, mass, charge, and angular momentum, kind of like the statement in thermodynamics that the equilibrium state is determined by, you know, energy, chemical potential, angular momentum. Now, the entropy, the so-called, you know, this whatever plays the role of entropy in this analogy, it's proportional to the area, not to the volume. And so temperature happens to be inversely proportional to the mass, which means heat capacity is negative. So it's not the kind of thermodynamics that you normally see for normal gases, liquids, or solids. And you know, okay, so that's puzzling. So the black hole temperature actually was understood pretty quickly by Hawking, who kept thinking about this thermodynamics. And a couple of years later, he showed that if there exist particles, you know, protons, electrons, gravitons, whatnot, if quantum mechanics is taken into account, then black hole will radiate those particles. And an observer far away from the black hole, let's say a gas of particles with temperature, you know, inversely proportional to the mass, but there's not going to be this H bar sitting there because it's a quantum effect. So there's no particle radiation in classical gravity, of course. Now, and if you demand the first law, d, you know, dm is equal to tds, then you know your temperature has H bar, so your entropy is going to have 1/H bar. So this was black hole temperature. Okay. So Hawking's calculation, 1975, gives you a physical interpretation of how you can think about the temperature of black hole. However, it doesn't solve the problem of black hole thermodynamics, of course, because thermodynamics of the Hawking radiation is not the same as the thermodynamics of black hole. Okay? Because Hawking radiation is just a normal black body radiation. So its entropy of Hawking radiation is proportional to the volume, not to the area. Because Hawking radiation is just a normal gas of particles, it of course surely has positive specific heat. So the Hawking radiation does not explain the black hole entropy, because black hole entropy is a much, much harder problem than the black hole temperature. So, you know, the black hole entropy was much more difficult to interpret. And in fact, the complete solution how to understand the entropy of black holes in quantum gravity is still not known. Now, a partial solution is known, right? This partial solution came after many years of work by many, many smart people. I think Bekenstein's insight was very important, so he proposed that the black hole entropy has to be taken seriously, so there's got to be some physical degrees of freedom that give rise to the black hole entropy. And Toft in 1993 proposed this whole holographic paradigm of degrees of freedom living on some kind of surface accounting for the scaling of entropy with area. And in the 1990s, there are many there's a lot of work involving various realizations of how this black hole entropy is to understood using strings, brains, supersymmetry. Some of it worked. You know, there's an important calculation by Strominger and Wafa that explained, actually gave a microscopic interpretation for black hole entropy for particular kind of black holes. The complete picture was still missing. And a little bit later, there was, in 1997, there came a unification. Unification, you know, that kind of brought together these ideas about, you know, black holes, you know, thermodynamics, liquids, so. So the key insight was the so-called gauge gravity duality by Maldacena, 1997. So what Maldacena proposed is, he proposed that gravity in 4+1 dimensions is equivalent to a quantum system in 3+1 dimensions. And moreover, he didn't just say it and wave his hands. He actually proposed how you can realize this in string theory. So his idea became very, very influential. And in fact, if you look at citations of his paper in the Spires database, so as of 2010, this is second most cited paper of all time in high energy physics. So the first, of course, most cited paper is the standard model of particle physics, the electroweak unification due to Weinberg. And so Maldacena's paper is the second most cited paper. I mean, you should be, of course, very careful judging the importance of papers solely based on the number of citations. But this tells you that, you know, many, many people were inspired by his work. So the relation that Maldacena proposed was a duality, which is analogous to the kind of duality in quantum mechanics, where one and the same state can be either described by a position space wave function or momentum space wave function. Right? One and the same thing, either think about this in terms of position space wave function or momentum space wave function. Same here. One and the same thing, you can either think about this in terms of gravity in 4+1 dimensions, or you can think about this as a quantum system in quantum field theory in 3+1 dimensions. Okay. So this kind of duality between classical gravity and quantum field theory. And the idea how this works is you put gravity in a box. So this is your space-time in a box. This is boundary of a box. And it is that this boundary on the box has degrees of freedom that are associated with your quantum many-body system in 3+1 dimensions. Now, the box is, of course, not made by some kind of matter around space, because you cannot do this. But the box is automatically provided by a special kind of dark energy, which is just a negative cosmological constant. And the way it works is that the curvature of space-time near the boundary tells you about the information about the quantum system at the boundary of your space-time. So if you put a black hole in your space-time, this corresponds to heating up this quantum system that lives on the boundary. So if you have a black hole here, this means you have your quantum many-body system at non-zero temperature at the boundary. All right, and now the way this correspondence works is that the entropy of this black hole in d dimensions coincides with the entropy of the quantum system that lives on the boundary in d minus one dimensions, because the boundary has one dimension less than the bulk. All right. Now this tells you that black hole thermodynamics now makes perfect sense, because it tells you that thermodynamics of black hole in 4 plus 1 dimensions has to be thought of as thermodynamics of the quantum system that lives in 3 plus 1 dimensions, that is on the boundary. That is, the thermodynamics of this black hole, you should think about it as thermodynamics of the degrees of freedom that live on the boundary. And you actually know exactly what these degrees of freedom are for many black holes. You can actually write down the Hamiltonian of what the quantum mechanical system is. Entropy is now proportional to the volume, as usual, but it's the volume of the boundary, which would look like the area from the bulk point of view. Heat capacity is positive. Equation of state actually happens to be very close to the equation of the ideal gas in 3 plus 1 dimensions. I haven't yet told you who lives on the boundary. I haven't yet told you what exactly are those degrees of freedom that are associated with the boundary of space-time. And it depends. It depends, because in the bulk here, you have gravity coupled to various matter fields, you know, electromagnetism, other particles that you can imagine. And depending on the matter content that is interacting with gravity here, you will have different different Hamiltonians, different quantum systems that live on the boundary of your spacetime. Okay. And typically, what lives on the boundary of spacetime is, you know, quarks, gluons, other stuff. So, you know, the prototypical example of how this works, it's SUN, supersymmetric Yagi-Noth theory, that has many features which are similar to quantum chromodynamics. Now, why is this duality useful between, you know, black holes and quantum field theory that lives on the boundary? Well, it's useful for the following reason. Well, one of the reasons is this: quarks and gluons, they can turn into each other. Okay? They don't just, you know, fly, you know, by themselves. They can turn into each other, and the probability of their converting into each other is controlled by this parameter alpha s, which is the QCD coupling constant. This coupling constant of QCD is not a constant, just like in QED is not a constant. It depends on energy. It runs, and the way it runs in QCD, well, the way it runs in any asymptotically free gauge theory is it becomes smaller at high energy, which means it becomes larger at low energy. So if you think, looks much better on the screen. Anyway, this scale here is, I think that's 1 GeV. It's 1 GeV. Now, the phase transition between the hadrons and the quark gluon plasma is here. So this means that coupling here is actually not small. And moreover, over here, you know, you already cannot trust this curve because you cannot trust the perturbative calculations. So when your interactions between quarks and gluons are strong, the quantum system is very, very complex. It's like very, very, very complex. So it's a system where the very notion of particles makes no sense. So particles don't exist. So the only thing that exists there are quantum fields, but not particles. Now, this duality between gravity and gauge theory, it reduces the problem to classical gravity. Now, dealing with classical gravity is not easy. Gravity is complicated, but it's still way easier than QCD. So that's one reason why many people got excited about this duality, because they thought, that they can understand some features of QCD from classical gravitation. Well, okay. Now, so what lives on the boundary is a strongly interacting quantum system. Now, as I told you earlier, strongly interacting quantum systems are the best candidates for most ideal liquids in nature. So you can ask the question, so whatever lives on the boundary, can you think about this as a liquid? And the answer is, you can. Does it flow? It does. Can you compute its viscosity? You can. So how do you think about viscosity? Well, you think about it in the following way. So take this black hole, and you nudge the black hole a little bit. So you can nudge the black hole in many different ways. You can jump into it. For example, that's one way to do it. Well, you can do it in other ways. But basically, when you nudge a black hole, it will start oscillating. And when this black hole here oscillates, the disturbance of space-time, it propagates out into the boundary. It propagates from here to the boundary. And when you look at the equations that describe the dynamics on the boundary here, these equations exactly look like the relativistic Navier-Stokes equations. So what this tells you is that the relativistic Navier-Stokes equations are actually encoded in classical gravity. They're encoded in classical gravitation with specific values of, shear viscosity, bulk viscosity, and heat conductivity, which are the three parameters I told you that are needed to describe viscous fluids. Actually, it turns out that for all black holes that are described by Einstein gravity, the ratio of shear viscosity to the density of entropy is h bar divided by 4 pi. So there's a huge variety of strongly interacting quantum liquids, all of which have viscosity divided by entropy equal to h bar over 4 pi, which is about 0.8 h bar. Now, if you think about the viscosity of the quark-gluon liquid, the actual quark-gluon liquid created at RIC and LHC, that's about the right number. Well, that's about the right order of magnitude that's used in hydrodynamic simulations to describe the actual data. Now, this does not tell you that the actual quark-gluon plasma should be thought of as an actual black hole in empty de Sitter space. But what this tells you is that it actually provides you a sensible example of a system which is a gauge theory, strongly interacting gauge theory like QCD, whose thermodynamics looks very, very close to the thermodynamics of ideal gas, just like it does in QCD, but whose flow looks very, very different from the flow of the ideal gas. Again, just like happens in QCD. Right. So again, so if something has kinematic viscosity as small as 104 pi, it cannot be a gas of particles just by the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. But the equation of state is very, very close to the ideal gas, right? So it is possible. It is possible to have such systems, to have liquids whose equation of state is very, very close to the ideal gas, but whose kinematic viscosity is smaller than any other liquid that exists in nature. Again, so this is something that only was understood maybe less than 10 years ago. Now, so black holes that I was talking about were black holes that were similar to the quark-gluon liquid. There are other kinds of black holes, other black holes which are similar to superfluids. Yes, there are. I couldn't find a good picture that kind of gives you a nice visual representation of this type of black holes. But these black holes, they're called holographic superconductors or holographic superfluids. And what these plots show you, they show you the magnitude of the order parameter, which characterizes the symmetry breaking of the system, extracted from the equations of gravity in the bulk of empty de Sitter space as a function of temperature. And these plots kind of look like what you would typically see in condensed matter textbooks, when the order parameter goes to zero at the phase transition. Exactly, actually, what happened like happens in the Landau theory of phase transitions. Now, the way you should think about this holographic superfluids or holographic superconductors is that there's an extra parameter which characterizes these black holes, which is the condensate. And at low temperatures, the black holes develop hair, which is precisely the superfluid condensate. And the appearance of hair on the black hole, this corresponds to the superfluid phase transition in the liquid that lives on the boundary.
By here, I mean a parameter that characterizes the black hole that does not vanish, that you can still pick up information about the black hole from infinity.
Is it just a scalar
field? All right.
So, lessons to remember. Black holes have been useful to learn lessons about strongly interacting quantum liquids. The connection between this black holes quantum liquids, it comes from string theory. This universal relation, it makes you think seriously that nature dislikes perfect fluidity by the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. And the last point is that the most perfect liquid found to date is about a billion times hotter than the sun. So if you look at this picture here, then you see that some things never change. Happy playing with viscosity. Thank you very much. Other questions? Comments?
Disbeliefs? Does this make sense even remotely? Do you know everything that I said so far?
Was there anything at all that was new? Was there anything at all that was familiar?
All right. Well, thank you for coming, guys. I'd be happy to talk about this if you want to. I'm here at Penn Central in the year. But, yeah.